As ticket holders arrived to see the evening's show on Monday, October 22nd, they had to make their way through a huge, angry crowd gathered outside the Walnut Street Theater. By curtain time, according to many Philadelphia newspapers and their headlines the next day, the city was experiencing a race riot. Wrote a reporter, 2,000 shouting Negroes and white persons completely blocked the streets. Although 50 policemen hurried to the scene, the mob at times threatened to get beyond their control. At all times, the situation was dangerous. One Negro in the gallery got into a fight and was badly beaten up. His head was bleeding profusely as he was led from the theater. While waiting for the patrol wagon to come and take the man to City Hall, 100 or more excited persons surrounded the policeman and the bleeding Negro, threatening trouble unless the man was released. Hisses and hoots resounded on all sides. Fresh fuel was added to the disturbance when a policeman fired 3 shots at a little colored boy who was running away. The crowd, for a moment, started to hem in the policeman, but the timely arrival of another patrol full of bluecoats averted any outbreak. Hurried phone calls were sent, and the order was given to clear the streets. Back and forth the mob surged, excited and needing only a single spark to set them off into hysterical violence. Numerous fights were in progress, and the trolleys were powerless to move. Everybody was expecting trouble. One excited Negro yelled, "Let's go inside and wreck the house!" Welcome back to Adventures in Theater History. We continue our season number 2, Drama is Conflict, with yet another story about an angry crowd, thousands of people filling the street outside a Philadelphia theater. Sounds familiar if you've heard our recent series about the play The Quaker City back in 1844, but this disturbance was in the year 1906. And we have arrived at a different time in Philadelphia history. 72 years on from our last tale, though we're still in Philadelphia, and though the old Chestnut Street Theater that we talked about last time was long gone, now we're in a different universe in terms of Philadelphia's overall story. Because by now, by 1906, Philadelphia was a huge, modern, industrial city. From a population of just under 100,000 back in the early 1840s and just a few square miles in size, Philadelphia had now expanded to over 140 square miles, and it had a population of 1.5 million people. Factories belched smoke all over town. The cramped shipyard along the Delaware River churned out enormous steel vessels every week. The Baldwin locomotives built near Logan Square ran swiftly along the Pennsylvania and Reading railroads, and hundreds of trolley cars ran along every major street, competing for space both with horses and even those newfangled automobiles. And if you stood and looked from the peak of the tallest central tower of the recently completed City Hall on Center Square, the homes, because Philadelphia now called itself the City of Homes, stretched to the horizon. Most importantly, Philadelphia's demographics had changed. The old animosities between Catholics and Protestants had largely been abandoned. The Catholic Church hierarchy, in fact, was extremely influential in many Philadelphians' lives, even though the old WASP and Quaker aristocracy still ruled the highest levels of society. In fact, many of the old line families that led the city in the 1840s were still quite prominent, though few were directly involved in politics anymore. But there had also been a huge influx of hundreds of thousands of immigrants from Italy, from Ireland, from the Austrian and Russian empires. The factories, the warehouses, the office buildings of the city were hungry for workers, and Philadelphia hummed night and day with activity. The benefits of all this demographic and economic expansion were not necessarily equally shared. And although in 1906 we are just before the beginnings of what is usually termed the Great Migration, the city's long-established black community was definitely attracting many new migrants coming up from the South. The number of African Americans in Philadelphia, which stood at about 32,000 in 1880 and had almost doubled to 63,000 in 1900, well, by 1906, that number was still somewhere around 70,000, just under 5% of the overall population of the city. There were hundreds of black-owned businesses, including the Philadelphia Tribune newspaper, established in 1884, and the Douglas Hospital, opened in 1895, which served the African-American population and trained black nurses and doctors. The Philadelphia Colored Directory, which was a publication then, in 1910 listed 78 black men as being physicians, 16 as dentists, and 13 lawyers. 143 were professional musicians, and 169 were ministers at the local black churches. Remember that last fact. It becomes important later. We've already noted in this podcast, in our episodes about John Arnault, the Black Booth, that by the late 1880s, the Republican Party of Philadelphia was in control and was actively courting the vote of these black men in local elections. And indeed, their votes often proved critical to keeping the GOP political machine in power in City Hall. So the black community had some scope and influence, and by the 1890s, it was even the subject of an extended formal sociological investigation in W.E.B. Du Bois' famous 1899 book entitled The Philadelphia Negro. But as Du Bois discovered, the overwhelming majority of black people in the city were confined to lower-level positions in the economy, and a great number worked as servants in other people's houses. But let's return to our own particular little bailiwick. What about the city's theaters? How had they changed? Instead of the four major Philadelphia theaters of the 1840s, in the beginning of the 20th century, there were dozens of theaters all over the city, from large ones like the Academy of Music and the Grand Opera House, standing over Broad Street, to legit theaters which hosted large touring shows like the Broad Street Theater, the Garrick Theater, and the Walnut Street Theater, to vaudeville houses like Keith's Bijou and the Adelphi. Oh, there was the whole grand panoply of American show business of the time, all the way down to the burlesque and minstrel shows and dime museums in the Tenderloin neighborhood north of Market Street. Even a smattering of Nickelodeons and those new moving pictures. Most Philadelphians went to live theaters multiple times a year, but I'm very sorry to tell you that the somewhat remarkable free mixing of the races in the audience that in season one we noted was the general rule in the 1870s and 80s had now reverted back to the situation closer to that of 1844. The post-Civil War advances in rights to public accommodations had been largely lost in Philadelphia and elsewhere in America, after the decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court in such cases as Plessy v. Ferguson, most Philadelphia theaters would once again only sell black people tickets to the highest upper balconies in the back, if they sold them tickets at all. In fact, due to the common practices of box office managers, blacks often had to wait to buy even these few balcony tickets until just before curtain time to make sure no white people wanted those seats first. Du Bois was quite pointed in his study about race prejudice generally hindering African Americans in just about every part of their civic life, and theaters were certainly no exception to that rule. Were black Philadelphians trying to come to the theaters? Well, yes, but not a lot. According to Du Bois, most of the working-class black people of the city, though they might occasionally attend a theater or a concert, mostly got their entertainment through their churches or church social functions. In fact, many of the more conservative and religious blacks, like many other American Christians of all races in that time, rather distrusted theaters entirely. There was, however, about an upper 10% of the black population, he observed, especially the old Philadelphia families from the 7th Ward, that might have the inclination, education, and income to attend the theater. And indeed, we saw that in 1887, when the opportunity to see serious black actors doing Shakespeare had presented itself, they had flocked to do so at the Academy of Music. But we also learned that black actors and theater artists often found it impossible to even work regularly on the stage. Indeed, the efforts of our old friends, R. Henry Strange and Major Tagle, to found a black Shakespeare company in the city had fallen short. Another group, which I haven't had the chance to tell you about yet, to start a black theater in South Philadelphia at a former hall at 5th and Gaskell Streets, had been quickly outbid by a group of Yiddish theater artists who wanted to serve the city's burgeoning Jewish immigrant population. Well, soon the great Boris Tomaszewski himself was running a theater company in Philadelphia. But hopeful black theater artists in the city, once again, found themselves without a home. So, if there was interest but not much participation by the city's African Americans in the world of the theater, what exactly was going on at the Walnut Street Theater in October of 1906? What suddenly had gotten so much of their attention? Why were thousands of people, which would have been an astoundingly large percentage of the entire black community of the city, out on the street? And why were they rioting? But wait, was it thousands of people? Were they rioting in the way that that word is usually used? Do we really trust that narrative? In the newspaper story we quoted at the beginning of the episode, there certainly was a lot of sensational language about potential violence. But if we read on in the story, there were also many instances of black people gathering around and calling for peace and discussion and temperance. Only the white policeman who fired those three shots did something truly alarming, and he reportedly was soon surrounded and met only with stern looks and words of reproof, not blows. But still, something quite major was clearly going on. So let's first step back a bit and question whether the account that we just heard, taken from a major white newspaper, The Inquirer, was really accurate. I've gone into the archives of other big Philadelphia papers of the day, including the North American and the Evening Bulletin, and found that their accounts, well, they largely track with the description in The Inquirer. The headline in the North American read, 3,000 Negroes start riot trying to stop objectionable play. Three are arrested and one clubbed by police. Women faint following wild yells of disturbers in gallery. Close quotes. Even The Sun, the main newspaper down in nearby Baltimore, Maryland, reported that a Negro mob menaced the theater. Furthermore, The Sun editorialized, quote, things have reached a pretty pass indeed if the American stage is to be left in any degree at the mercy of mobs, if religious or racial fanaticism is to make our theaters the scenes of rioting and bloodshed. Close quotes. The Baltimorean editor urged the Philadelphia authorities to act sternly and strongly. My goodness, had things reached that point? Were we back in the bad old days of the 1840s? Did we need to call out the militia and shoot into crowds? So, to get a different point of view, the obvious thing to do would be to check how the Philadelphia Tribune, the major black newspaper of the city, reported on that same incident. Unfortunately, we can't see that week's editions of the Tribune anymore, as a fire at their offices in 1912 would destroy all the archives from their early years. But we do have an account from another black newspaper in a nearby city, again, Baltimore, the Baltimore Afro-American, where a reporter on the scene related events transpiring in a somewhat less alarming manner. Quote, Philadelphia, PA, October 24th. This has been a week of excitement in this city. The play which opened here at the Walnut Street Theater on Monday evening has had a strenuous time. A demonstration was made by the colored people in front of the theater, and a crowd, variously estimated to be from 300 to 3,000, was present to voice their objection to this race-strife-creating play. The crowd was orderly, and but for the interference of some hoodlums, there would have been no trouble. As it was, only two persons were arrested, both of them being boys, As usual, the press dispatches sent out from the city stated that the colored people were riotous and that there was a riot call sent in, but there is no truth in the statement there was a riot, for there was none. Close quotes. So, by our terms today, it seems that perhaps there was more of what we would call a protest or a mass demonstration. Today, of course, everyone would have had their cell phones out, recording everything. Back then, everyone rushed to get their hot takes printed in the newspapers, and race riot was a buzzword of that day, used to describe almost any public confrontation where race was an issue at all. And I also ought to tell you that going into the microfilm archives and looking at all the front pages of Philadelphia's many daily newspapers, the Inquirer, the Public Ledger, the Press, the Evening Bulletin, the North American, a crusading liberal newspaper of the day, we don't even find this race riot story, in quotes, placed by their editors at the top of their front pages. It wasn't the day's biggest story, in other words. Though there was a drawing of rioting people at the very top of the North American's front page on October 23rd, a political cartoon of a marching group of angry citizens carrying a huge black flag with a skull and crossbones on it with the words, "Let us end this talk of civic righteousness." But this drawing showed all white people, not black. They weren't protesting about what was going on in theaters. This was all about something bigger. According to the editors, the ongoing battle within the Republican Party about reforming the notoriously corrupt Philadelphia city government. For you Philadelphia history fans, this was the time of the Municipal League and the Committee of 70. For those of you who don't know or care anything about that period of Philly history, well, let's see. It was kind of like, well, the Russian Revolution of 1905, which was happening at the same time on the other side of the world. And just as in Russia, for about a year, there was huge agitation and action. The forces of reform seemed to triumph for a while, and then, just when the day seemed won, there was a gradual dissipation of energy as the old guard regained power once again. Speaking of the old guard, or gang, as the reforming newspapers called them, the ostensible leader of the city was Mayor John Weaver, a Republican lawyer who had been elected in 1903. But the real power brokers of the city remained in the background, collecting graft and doling out contracts. And by 1906, Weaver had been dealing with the fallout over a huge scandal about crooked contracts involving Philadelphia's municipally owned natural gas company. Mayor Weaver, to his credit, had turned against the bosses and was prosecuting the malefactors. For over a year, there had been mass public meetings, angry demonstrations outside city council members' homes, huge marches in the streets, but not, as we should note, about civil rights, and certainly not about plays. But here's my point. Just as we saw back in 1844, when controversial plays are put on in theaters in an otherwise overheated political climate, dangerous things begin to happen. So, returning to our story, what was the object of this mass demonstration outside the Walnut Street Theater? What was the play inside the Walnut? What mere drama could have possibly caused this much outrage? Was it because all the black characters in the play were being performed by white actors in blackface? Because that was definitely happening. Well, it wasn't just an ordinary minstrel show. Believe me, as we noted in our podcast about the history of minstrel shows in Philadelphia, those were a long-established institution at that time. Black Philadelphians may not have cared much for them, but they were not, on the whole, something that black people got very exercised about. Not back then. There were still some vestiges of black minstrel companies, after all, and even a major African-American musical star like Burt Williams himself, who had often performed in the city's theaters, was still working in blackface, and people on the whole were quite proud of him. No, this was something different altogether. Although in many ways, this particular play had the plot elements of many a melodrama performed in many a theater in Philadelphia, in other ways, this was a startlingly new type of play. It was called The Klansman. written by the novelist and former clergyman Thomas W. Dixon. Now, I bet as soon as you heard that title, The Klansman, that you immediately intuited that it was pretty awful. Only guess what? It was even worse than that, that thing that you just thought of. It was just unspeakable. And yet, here I am to speak about it. This is the job that I've assigned myself. And I think it's important that I do, because what was going on in that awful play back in 1906 was a real progenitor to much of the worst political discourse and white supremacist rhetoric and racist imagery that are cropping up all over again in America today. Many of us had thought they had long been defeated and discredited, but no, not at all, as it turned out. They rise again, stronger than ever. We should know where that comes from, so we too can fight it. That's the way we can honor the people who stood out on Walnut Street in protest that evening in October 1906, even as many of their fellow Philadelphians eagerly trooped inside to see the show. So again, what happened in this play, The Klansman? Okay, here we go. As the curtain rose, the first scene opened in the town of Piedmont, South Carolina. In November of 1867, it is Election Day, and Reconstruction is in full swing. The black troops of the Union Army still occupy the former territory of the Confederacy. Now, as the playwright Thomas Dixon paints the action, that meant the newly freed Southern slaves are exulting in at last having power over white people, especially power over the Camerons, the local, gracious family of former planters whose house is at center stage overlooking a cliff. A river valley is seen off in the distance. The stage directions read, quote, "Characteristic crowd of Negroes grouped in the roadway, some lined up along a cliff fence, a straggling few below the hedgerows enclosing the Cameron house, all laughing, talking, shouting with noisy enthusiasm. Pocket flasks are passed from hand to hand. Two or three, with bunches of ballots in hand, circulate in a purposeful way among the throng. Negro troopers pass, joyously saluted by the crowd. Two or three white males make their way through the crowd. One exits right, by way of the road. Two come forward and, with dubious shaking of heads and exchange of meaning looks, exeunt to Cameron House." Now, at this point, the spoken dialogue begins. The very first person to speak, in fact, is a Negro preacher who is haranguing the crowd of black voters, promising them all 40 acres and a mule if they vote right. "Bottom rail on top," exults a black peddler in the crowd, "while your old master works your land and pays you his rent in corn." Another Negro voter named Alec reveals that he is a member of a secret society called the Black League, who is sworn to keep the vote from the white man and to keep blacks in continual power throughout the South forever. Now, all of these lines were written in the worst kind of stage Negro dialect. I won't quote them directly because I absolutely decline to subject all of your ears to it. It's been published. You can find the play yourself. I'll put the reference in the bibliography on the episode blog post on our webpage. Go look it up if you need to read that. But of all the white people who were gathered in the Philadelphia audience that night in 1906, not one of them rose to protest to stop the show when they heard it. This was not out of line with many other Southern melodramas of the day, after all. They all would have heard that dialect many times, not just in minstrel shows. Heck, you could read jokes in colored dialect in the Philadelphia newspapers every day. But importantly, though they may have seen similar scenes on the stage before, and many may have even read the best-selling novel the play was based upon, none of them had ever experienced it mixed with such blood-curdling and emotionally laden political messaging. The impact of this play was clear. The story of its plot was pointed. Black people and their white liberal enablers had humiliated and degraded the white people of the South during Reconstruction, and the white people of the South had rightfully fought back and seized their dignity and protected their women folk from forced interracial marriage. That's what the play was about. Now, fearing trouble, the management of the theater had lined the back of the house with Philadelphia policemen. But almost as soon as the curtain rose on this appalling spectacle, one young black man named Henry Jenkins had already seen enough. Soon after the curtain rose, he reached under his seat where he had stashed a box of eggs and began hurling these eggs at the stage, scattering all those white actors pretending to be black. Jenkins was quickly spotted by one Officer Rooney of the 19th District. Here's the description from a report in the papers. The gallery, which was filled with colored men, cheered Jenkins on, and when Rooney, with three other fellow policemen, went to arrest the colored man, the onlookers were in an angry mood. Jenkins fought desperately, assisted by his friends, and after clubbing him, the policemen had to fight their way through the crowd to the exit. Meanwhile, the house was in turmoil. Close quotes. Police then dragged their detainee, bleeding from the head, out onto Walnut Street, and another man, Butler Williams, then attempted to lead a rescue of Jenkins, only to be beaten and arrested himself. A boy pulled away a pole supporting an overhead trolley electrical line, and as he ran away, one officer fired three shots. Fortunately, his aim was poor, and amazingly, no one was hit by one of his stray bullets in the crowded streets. After all this interruption, the play inside on the stage continued, though occasional paper missiles, likely folded-up theater programs, descended on the stage from the upper balcony from time to time. As the first act ended, some white people in the lower orchestra sections got worried and began to leave. But if that's what they did, then they missed a lot of what the Klansmen still had to show them and the rest of the audience who remained. They missed the scenes in Act Two, where the biracial son of a white northern politician arrives to take over the South Carolina government. They missed when the young white men in the play are recruited into a southern army of resistance, an organization based upon the Scottish Highland clans described in Sir Walter Scott's novels. They missed the scenes in Act Three, where the Ku Klux Klan assembles in an eerily lit cavern to interrogate a fiendish black man accused of murdering a young white girl and decide he is guilty based upon the evidence of a microscope's image of the murder victim's horrified face embedded in the back of his eye. Yes, that was a plot point. The black man then confesses his crime and describes how the girl jumped off a cliff to escape him. They missed a speech by an actor playing Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Ku Klux Klan himself. They missed the final scene, where the whole Klan rides to the rescue, actual horses on the stage, to save young Ben Cameron from execution and the family mansion from being sold off to the evil villain, and as a comic black faithful retainer strikes down a fiendish black politician, all while ironically yelling, "Ain't I yo equal?" And they missed the enthusiastic applause from the Philadelphia crowd at the final curtain. During all this, the Philadelphia Director of Public Safety, Robert McKenty, stood outside the theater on Walnut Street. Three prominent black clergymen, Reverend Matthew Anderson, Reverend E.W. Moore, and the Reverend Dr. Talia Farrow of the Holy Trinity Baptist Church, who had earlier been ejected from the house, walked up to him and asked McKenty that the show immediately be stopped. "I can't arbitrate this here, gentlemen," responded McKenty, keeping a watchful eye on the surging and angry crowd and on the departing audience members threading their way out the front door. "Only the mayor could do that." But he promised the ministers that if they would meet him and Mayor Weaver tomorrow morning, they could perhaps draw up together an order forbidding the Klansmen ever being performed in the city of Philadelphia ever again. Well, that's quite enough for today. I can only marvel at the group of Philadelphia preachers who all bought tickets and sat and watched a play, or tried to, that they knew was written to offend them and defame their race and maybe drive the white audience around them into a frenzy. Because after all, That is what the author, Thomas Dixon, was intending to do. In an essay published earlier that same year, entitled Why I Wrote the Klansman, Dixon said, "The production of this, my first play, has been the most thrilling work of my life." And then he cited with glee a review from a New York reporter who had seen an earlier performance of the same play in Charleston, South Carolina. Quote, "As a means of sowing the seed of revulsion for the black man, this play cannot be well ignored. To those who have the future harmony of the two races at heart, the presentation of the Klansman must come as a crushing blow. I believe that the stage is the best medium for placing this tremendously vital question before the whole people. My play cannot be misunderstood. In the fierce glare of the footlights, its purpose and the lesson it conveys becomes clear to every man and woman in this broad and fair land of ours. It is indeed the writing on the wall. Will the American people heed its warning?" Yeesh. Well, what will happen next? Was this play's further performance banned in Philadelphia? Would Dixon's disgusting and offensive production continue its national tour? Would further uproar and further protest result? Would there be actual race riots? Who was this man, this Thomas Dixon, and why did theater producers of the day give him such an open public platform to spread his racist views? All that and more will be in our next two episodes. Continue to listen in and continue to support our podcast as we continue the story. Write us and let us know what you think. AITHpodcast@gmail.com. I want to hear from you. As I've often said, sometimes theater history is not a pretty story, but it's never not an important one. I'm Peter Schmitz, and our music and sound engineering are by Christopher Mark Colucci. Thank you once again for your kind attention. Please check out our social media feeds on Facebook and Instagram. Not Twitter, not anymore. Please visit our website, www.aithpodcast.com, for additional images and information and to listen to earlier episodes. And then like us and subscribe to our feed and give us some stars and reviews on whatever podcasting platform you are using. Most of all, please join us again in a few weeks' time when we continue this adventure in theater history, Philadelphia.